It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last night, Governor Tony Evers gave his State of the State address and laid out his priorities as he declared 2025 the year of the kid.
Folks, the obligation to help address the challenges our kids are facing in this 80% of the time they're not in school falls squarely at the feet of elected officials, including myself, in this building.
Among his priorities are to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in school mental health services statewide and to pass a red flag law in Wisconsin.
To break down his priorities for 2025, let's bring in WPR State Capitol reporter Anya Van Wagtendonk. Anya, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is the first state address since elections under the new legislative maps. Governor Evers again facing Republican-led chambers of the legislature, a small Republican majority. But what was the tenor like? What was the tone like in the chambers last night?
Yeah, honestly, if you are a politics nerd, the tenor of the state of the state is actually often just really nice. It kind of always feels like the first day of school or something. People are all dressed up. A lot of lawmakers bring guests. And there's just kind of this buzzing energy, people kind of catching up with one another. I've been curious about whether redistricting will lead to more tension in the Capitol. And maybe that will play out in committee hearings or votes. But there's been tension in the past. And, you know, I certainly didn't see any of that really on display last night.
Quickly afterward, though, some Republicans said about many Governor Evers' priorities, nope, sir, it's not going to happen this time around. We'll probably start again with their own budget. It sounds like what are the chances, before we get into particulars, what are the chances that we'll see a lot of what Governor Evers said actually pass into law?
Sure. Well, right afterwards, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss did say something like it was a list of things that will not happen in Wisconsin. But I would just note, this is now my third state of the state that I've covered, and this is kind of just how it goes. Evers says a bunch of things. Democrats clap. Republicans don't. Afterwards, Republicans say, we will do our own thing in the legislature. And so what we'll be kind of paying attention to over the next legislative session is what Republican proposals move forward that Evers will sign off on.
As we're hearing in the news, one place where it sounds like Republicans might go along, at least in part with Governor Evers, is mental health services in schools around the state. Evers putting out a number of $300 million. Some state lawmakers, key state lawmakers, say, well, maybe not that much, but maybe something more than what we're doing. Talk about what we're hearing on that issue.
Yeah, that was interesting. That was one of the things that Republicans did not sort of immediately dismiss out of hand afterwards. They said that mental health is vitally important to be investing in. Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahue said, you know, when he started in the body, we were putting about $0 towards that. And now there's about $30 million that the legislature approved in the last budget. And so he said they will continue to be looking at that. I am curious what the specifics of the $300 million ask will be. Two things that Evers named specifically were peer-to-peer suicide prevention support and then just more training for school staff. I don't know whether Republicans would sign off on $300 million. That is a large ask for Republican spending sort of preferences, but I'll be really interested to see how that conversation moves forward.
On a broader note, Governor Evers, former superintendent of education, former teacher, focusing, as he often does, on kids and education in the state. How broad was that focus?
It was interesting. He called for a broad investment in K through 12 education, but then didn't really go into specifics. That is the type of thing that, again, is often a source of back and forth between Republicans who control the legislature and Evers at the top. But I think that we will be seeing a little bit more specifics coming out from DPI, the agency that oversees the schools. One thing that Republicans also noted afterwards is that they will not support any type of increased funding for schools without getting a kind of commensurate commitment to standards, to elevating standards and evaluation. And so that's a fight that our education reporter, Corey Hess, will be focusing on very closely. But I think that's going to be the back and forth, is more testing or evaluation or something like that in exchange for more dollars for K through 12.
In the state of the state, we hear a lot of budget priorities like the education ones we've been talking about. There are also policy cases to be made in a state of the state address. Governor Evers talked about firearms-related legislation last night, closing loopholes in background checks. He said he wanted to see passing some kind of red flag law in Wisconsin. What kind of things did he put on the table?
Yeah, so two of those were sort of directly in response to the school shooting in Madison here in December. And these are programs that Democrats have pushed in the past. That loophole is about the private sale of guns. So right now, Wisconsinites do go through a background check if they purchase a firearm from a licensed dealer, but not if they, you know, buy from a friend or at a gun show or online. And then red flag laws essentially allow law enforcement to remove firearms from the home of someone who's deemed to be a threat. And Evers noted that in that Madison school shooting, the shooter had been in touch with somebody in California who allegedly wanted to carry out kind of a twin attack. And because there are red flag laws in California, that person's weapons were seized. And so he made the case that something like that in Wisconsin could potentially prevent future shootings like the one in Madison.
Evers also called for the creation of a self-assigned firearm exclusion program known as a SAFE program for short. How would that kind of program work?
Yeah, this was one of the more moving aspects of the night. Evers honored the family of Jonathan Brostoff, who is a former state rep from Milwaukee who died by suicide in November using a firearm. And so he talked about suicide as its own form of gun violence in a certain way. And so this program, it's almost like that red flag law, except a person can say, I am a threat to myself, and essentially register themselves as unable to buy a gun during a moment of crisis. He also called for a 48-hour waiting period between purchasing a gun and accessing it. That's something that used to exist in Wisconsin and was overturned about a decade ago. And I'll note, you know, again, when Republicans spoke to reporters afterwards, they said they will not support any of these gun packages.
We're talking about last night's State of the State address from Governor Evers. Anya Van Wagtendonk is with us, WPR State Capitol reporter. Child care, we've talked about a lot on the show. Expensive when it's available in many parts of the state. Governor Evers tackled this issue. Lawmakers offered up their own answers. Again, what are we hearing on this issue that's affecting a lot of families around the state?
Yeah, that was a major theme of the last legislative session. It was just sort of an ongoing fight. Again, really broke down on partisan lines. I do think almost every lawmaker agrees that, you know, many Wisconsinites struggle to afford childcare, and also that there's generally a shortage of childcare seats. When we talk about a childcare crisis, that's basically what that means. But there are just these huge philosophical, political disagreements about how to address those challenges. Do you help subsidize families so they can afford the programs? Do you help subsidize businesses so that they can create more available seats or pay their staffs more or invest in their buildings, whatever? Do you create tax breaks or incentives to families or to childcare providers? So essentially, as you can imagine, of what I just described, Republicans are generally on the side of tax incentives. Democrats are generally on the side of more state spending. And so I'll be interested to see what kind of proposals can actually move forward and then also get Evers' support.
Governor Evers also talked a lot about taxes and tax cuts. I believe he shared credit with Republican lawmakers in parts of the address when it came to cuts in taxes, especially for, I think, middle class Wisconsinites. What do we hear about the past and maybe future of taxes in the state?
Yeah, so he held up a report that we've reported on as well at WPR from the Wisconsin Policy Forum that found that the state and local tax burden dropped to a record low last year in the state. I think it was the largest drop of any state in the last 20 years. And that's basically just what percentage of your income goes to state and local taxes. And you're right. When you say shared the credit, a lot of Republicans afterwards were a little bit miffed about this because, again, taxes is just like an area where Republicans and Democrats often break down. Evers has signed off on a number of tax breaks in his time in office, but the fight is generally he has also vetoed a number of tax cut proposals from Republicans. And the argument is generally who benefits from those tax cuts. Evers has always said he will only support tax cuts for middle class families. He said, you know, his tax cuts contributed to that drop in tax burden, that they've led to about $1.5 billion in relief per year per family. But Republicans really said, you know, he's taking credit for their work on taxes and he's not sort of sufficiently supportive of their additional proposals for tax cuts.
Well, you mentioned politics nerds, Anya, and here in Wisconsin, it's a budget year and that's when politics nerds can really nerd out. What happens next in this 2-year budget process?
Yeah, so Evers, you know, hinted at a number of things that he will propose in his budget proposal, but the full thing will kind of be unveiled at another one of these late night addresses at the Capitol in late February. And generally, the way that that happens, especially here with divided government, with a GOP held legislature and a Democrat in the executive office, is he will unveil his proposals. Republicans will say, no, thank you. And then they will go into the Joint Finance Committee, is the budget writing committee, and it is held by Republicans, and they will essentially rewrite the whole document. There might be things in there that they'll hold on to. There are a lot of things in there that actually just have to be funded. There are just mandates in place. But anything that there's, you know, legislative discretion on, Republicans will use that discretion. And so they'll ultimately kind of develop a Republican spending proposal. And then it's up to Evers to decide what he wants to veto. He can line item veto in there. But otherwise, you know, Wisconsin, unlike Congress, does not have the option to not pass a budget. And so something will get signed in probably June or July.
I can imagine a world where with divided government, so the governor's people and Republican lawmakers' people sit down together, hash out compromises, come up with a plan they all don't love but can live with, and they do it that way. That hasn't happened. It's not going to happen, right?
More or less, yeah. I don't think that there have been a lot of meetings between Republican leaders and Governor Tony Evers, although there have been more in his second term than there were in his first. But you're right. There's not really that kind of we all sit around a table during those budget hearings that I mentioned. They often go kind of late at night. And it's very often, you know, the Republicans will put forward a proposal. Democrats will put forward amendments or their own proposals and make sort of these impassioned arguments for different priorities. And then again, there's usually a party line vote. Republicans beat Democrats because there's more of them. And so the Republican proposal kind of moves forward. There's a saying in the Capitol that's essentially Democrats get their say and Republicans get their way. And so I think the budget process often follows that as well. But there have been major bipartisan agreements in the last session as well over how the state supports local communities, over the Brewers Stadium funding package. And so it will be really interesting to see, you know, especially now with changes in the White House.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Anya Van Wagtendonk, WPR State Capitol reporter, with us for a recap of Governor Evers' State of the State address last night. Find additional reporting on this at WPR.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, after being diagnosed with schizophrenia, a doctor told him he'd never work again.
I was kind of raised to believe that you don't talk about mental health or mental illness. Whatever you're dealing with, you handle it yourself.
A Wisconsinite's mental health journey and strategies for the workplace. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. When Westby native Cody Green was first diagnosed with schizophrenia nearly a decade ago, he was told he would never work again.
The diagnosis triggered new mental health issues like increased stress, anxiety, and depression. He joined mental health peer support groups and learned how his medical care team could help to relieve some side effects.
But coworkers and managers at job sites, they treated him differently.
Now Green is out with a book on his experiences. It's called Mind Over Meetings, A Personal Perspective on Wellness in the Workplace. Cody Green, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Take us back to the years leading up to your diagnosis. When did you first notice possible signs or that something was not right?
Well, a lot of people don't know, but I actually, before I started advocacy and before I had my own schizophrenia diagnosis, I was actually raised by a mother with schizoaffective disorder. And so I kind of spent a lot of my middle school, high school years being a caregiver for her. When I went off to college is actually when I started having symptoms like hallucinations, delusions, and paranoia. And it was several years after that I got a diagnosis. So it was quite a process. Unfortunately, because of the delusional disorder, I was unable to recognize the symptoms in myself, even having grown up being a caregiver for my mom. So I ended up struggling with addiction and even incarceration before I was able to get a proper diagnosis and get help.
I also understand that mental health really wasn't discussed openly in your family. Why do you think that was as you were caring for a mother?
I think it was just a little bit of a cultural thing in the Midwest and in rural areas. Even to today, I see a lot of this where families are not willing to have these conversations. It's largely due to the stigma surrounding mental health and mental illness. And the reason that I'm trying to educate people is so that we're more willing and able to have these conversations with our friends and family members to make sure that they're getting resources and access to care.
When the doctor told you that there was no way you'd be able to work again or hold down a steady job, you said it felt like a death sentence and you felt really alone and confused and scared. What was this time like for you at work?
It was so frustrating because I knew that if I had the right help and assistance that I would be able to work just like anyone else. But that required me having access to the right medication and treatment. It also required employers to be willing to accommodate me and be able to help me as I navigate the workplace. And so I just wanted to try to live a normal life. I wanted to have what everyone else was able to have. And for a long time, that didn't seem possible. So years into me navigating the workplace and being fired from jobs and let go from jobs, I started just keeping track of different ways that I was able to make my day-to-day life easier in the workplace. And that's kind of how I ended up getting to the point of writing this book.
You felt embarrassment and humiliation. You said telling HR that you had schizophrenia. Can you talk about that moment or the moment when you disclosed to your workplace about needing accommodations?
It was really scary, but also, like you said, I talk about being really embarrassing. And the reason for that is I was kind of raised to believe that you don't talk about mental health or mental illness. Whatever you're dealing with, you handle it yourself. And so I had a hard enough time coming to terms with it myself. So that made it much more difficult when I had to start telling people like my employer, telling different friends and family members, and it made it hard for me to come to terms with it myself. So once I was able to really deal with my diagnosis, having to start telling people was not only scary, but it was frustrating and definitely embarrassing.
What are the sorts of jobs that you had with this diagnosis, and what were some of those barriers at work?
Because of my addiction, I did have a criminal record, which already made getting a job really difficult, and maintaining a job was extremely hard for me because I had mental health concerns, and so I basically took any jobs that I could get. I've been really fortunate to actually work in a lot of different industries. I've worked in production, manufacturing, distribution, office jobs, and then even sales. And I went on to even work some management positions in certain jobs. I was really able to navigate the workplace through all of these different experiences. And it's also what allowed me to have a better idea of what different industries look like and trying to find something that fit me and the struggles that I had because of my unique disorder and my symptoms. It was hard for me to have jobs that most people had. I wasn't able to do some jobs just for safety concerns. And so moving on to jobs that I found more and more accommodating was kind of the path I had to take just to be able to find a workplace and a position that would work for me.
When should mental health come up as a conversation with your supervisor, with HR? Is it when the interviewing is happening, when the job is established? What is that give and take like? What is that timeline?
I always tell people that mental health and mental illness are a very individual experience. And what I mean by that is everyone experiences their symptoms differently. Their treatment, their medication is all going to be different. And I kind of look at pursuing jobs the same way. I always tell people that the way that I do it is I go through my interview process first, and I wait until I'm offered a job before I disclose any information. That being said, depending on a person's functionality, depending on whether or not they have an official diagnosis, they might choose to do something different. They might choose to be at a job for a while to show that they're able to do it well before they disclose it. But it's all going to come down to a person's comfort level and a person's knowledge about their diagnosis and education about what they're going through. And I think that is what I try to convey in the book, is that every person, because they have their own experience, their own unique experience, is also going to need their own unique way of getting through the workplace. And that's more than just when to bring it up, but also what kind of reasonable accommodations they need to ask for, knowing how they can have these conversations, not just with management, but maybe with close colleagues if they're comfortable, and finding ways to just make their day-to-day life more comfortable while being at work.
What might be some examples of reasonable accommodations that we might not even consider or think about?
For a lot of people, it's going to depend on what their diagnosis is, how it affects them. I've been very fortunate to work with a lot of different mental health advocates, including people with bipolar disorders, generalized anxiety, and then people with other disabilities as well, both physical and developmental. And so reasonable accommodations are something that anyone with a diagnosis can ask for. That's going to directly involve what kind of job they're working, but also how their mental illness affects their work. For me, I had reasonable accommodations kind of ranging from where my workspace was to allowing me to have background noise on to make sure that I didn't have any increased symptoms, whether that was just like a TV show playing on my phone, something like that. But reasonable accommodation also means that, you know, it doesn't disrupt the workplace, it doesn't make the work that you're doing unsafe or anything like that. So it really does come down to the type of role you're in. And that's why I, over the years, kept pursuing different types of jobs until I found something that really fit me.
We're talking with Wisconsin author Cody Green about his experiences living with schizophrenia. His new book explores inclusive work environments. It's called Mind Over Meetings. Cody, someone who is pursuing some accommodations or opening up conversations with HR, there might be concerns that there could be retaliation or that promotion that they really want isn't in the picture, perhaps, or they think that they won't be put up for a promotion based on some of their needs at work or accommodations. How would you approach a situation like that?
Yeah, and I definitely talk about this in the book because this is a very real concern. And although the landscape of mental health conversations has definitely changed a lot, even since, you know, COVID, we're talking more about mental health, we're talking more about mental illness. This is still a reality that some people might be discriminated against or unfairly treated because of disclosing a mental illness. The big thing for people to remember is that we have rights as workers, and knowing what your rights are and how to protect yourself against any sort of discrimination is really important. I also think that if you have the right conversations with HR and leadership, you're able to effectively disclose the illness, find good, reasonable accommodations, and the workplace that you're working for is doing what they're supposed to do, you should be able to not be affected by disclosing what you're going through. But it's going to largely come down to whether or not your employer follows regulations and whether or not you're able to have a good understanding with human resource and your leadership team.
Cody, I want to look at burnout for just a moment. And you have some really interesting insights about self-care and doing things to prevent burnout and to help with that feeling before, you know, to that point of burnout. What is preventative self-care?
Preventative self-care is just anything that you can do to make sure that you don't get to a point where you're unable to continue working effectively or safely. So when I talk about burnout, I think it's important for people to realize that burnout can happen to anyone, and anyone can have mental health issues. That's even people without a mental illness diagnosis. That's even people without a history of mental health issues. Anyone can struggle, and anyone can go through burnout. And the most common cause of burnout is workplace burnout. So it's really important for people to be taking preemptive measures the same way you would with, and I always use this analogy in the Midwest, especially for people in production and manufacturing jobs, but it's the same as equipment. You want to have preventative maintenance so you're not trying to fix broken down equipment. And I think that helps people in those types of roles really stop and think about, well, I wouldn't expect my equipment to run with no preventative care, you know? And so for people, it's anything you can do. For me, it's largely rest, making sure I have a good sleep schedule. It's exercising, it's eating right, and it's going to be different for everyone. A lot of people can tie in spiritual self-care or just being able to spend time with friends or family, being able to really feel whole outside of work is super important for maintaining your self-care while you're at work.
You also make to-do lists, I understand, every day. What goes into that?
Yeah, I tell people this a lot because when I was first diagnosed with schizophrenia, I had so much difficulty functioning day to day that I had to find ways of making it easier on myself and making it feel like I could do what everyone else did day to day. So I started making to-do lists, and when I first began, it was very simple things, as simple as getting out of bed or brushing my teeth or taking my medication. And when I would tell people that I would write those things down, people who didn't struggle with mental health issues would kind of laugh at it. They'd be like, you have to write down to remember to wake up. But for me, it was more about being able to get through one thing, because there was a point in my life where I couldn't even do those things. And so I started making to-do lists, and eventually I started being able to add more and more to these to-do lists. It was making me feel more accomplished, and plenty of studies have proven the effectiveness of having a to-do list, having goals and goal setting. So that can be an effective tool for everyone. And it's something that I, as you mentioned, I talk about a lot, and I'm very passionate about, because it helped me in my own journey. And I've seen it help a lot of not just patients with severe mental illness, but people who are struggling with situational mental health could be something that comes up in their own life. And it's something that they can do to kind of push through and have goals and a purpose, even if it's just for a short time.
In one of your recent jobs, you had a supportive company where you were able to use the company's employee assistance program and also the Family and Medical Leave Act. And I'm wondering, what do these types of programs, what impact do they have?
This comes back to making sure that a person understands their rights as a worker, but also knows what kind of resources are out there. So there are a lot of resources that employers have. There's also a lot of resources in local areas, depending on where you live. And most employers now have EAPs, which are employee assistant programs. And I had never known about them when I worked my first few jobs. And as time went on and I learned about what an EAP was, I found that I could call someone to be able to talk to someone about what I was going through. And sometimes they would even be able to offer additional resources like some therapy meetings or counseling, just something to help better understand what additional resources I needed. And I was also fortunate enough to be able to use FMLA at my last couple of jobs, which basically just made it so that if I needed to take time off, I wouldn't be fired for doing so, and it would allow me to have more time to be able to deal with my illness. And it actually led to me taking less time off than when I didn't have it, because I wasn't stressed about being let go if I had symptoms one day and had to leave, or if I needed to go through a medication change, or if something came up that I just wasn't able to deal with. It essentially just made sure my job was still there when I got back.
You have your pulse on this issue. I'm wondering, what direction is America, is Wisconsin headed for mental health support at work?
Yeah, I was able to interview Gabe Howard for this book, and he made an amazing analogy. And I, you know, as someone who travels the country and talks to patients and workers and human resource professionals all over the country, he said, what he said really resonated with me, because he said, we are past the starting line, but we are nowhere near the finish line. And I think that holds true. You know, if you look at where we were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, not just in terms of mental health in the workplace, but mental health conversations, disclosing mental illness, anything like that, we've definitely come a long way. I don't think that means we are at a place that we can really celebrate yet. There's a lot of work to be done. And so when I was writing my book, I really wanted it to be not just a guide for patients and people struggling with mental illness. I wanted it to be able to be used by human resource professionals, business leaders, and people that are helping individuals in the workplace, because we need them to understand the need for people in the workplace to be able to disclose illnesses, have access to resources and all these different things, and able to make it more inclusive and be able to have more people working and being able to live full and functional lives.
Cody, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your insights.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Cody Green is a mental health advocate from Westby in western Wisconsin. Nearly 10 years after receiving a diagnosis for schizophrenia, he explores inclusive work environments in his new book. It's called Mind Over Meetings.
Coming up, Governor Evers says Wisconsin should have citizen-led ballot initiatives. Find out how they work in other states and why state legislatures don't always want them.
State legislators do not want to give up this power. They know that they'll get overturned by voters. And again, it's not necessarily that policy would be to the left or to the right. It's that they lost some control over policy, and they're really reluctant to do so.
That's next on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Earlier this month, Governor Evers proposed a measure that would give citizens more lawmaking power. Currently, Wisconsin voters can only vote on referenda to change the state's constitution, and those referenda can only be added to the ballot by lawmakers.
The governor's proposal would allow voters to add initiatives to ballots themselves, including referenda that would change the constitution or state law. They would only require a simple majority to pass.
The proposal is likely to be scrapped, as prominent Republican lawmakers have already come out against it.
WPR listeners called in with ideas about initiatives they would want on the ballot. Let's listen to a message from John.
This could provide a reasonable method for citizens to agree to change laws so that we can find better funding sources for things like conservation. Whether it will happen with a Republican legislature and a Democratic governor, I have my doubts at this time, but the pendulum does swing, and I hope that it will swing in the direction of listening more to citizens in the not-too-distant future.
And we got a call from Suzanne.
I'm wholeheartedly in favor of citizen referendum. So looking at initiatives that would raise dollars for early care and education is of critical need.
And a listener named Christina wrote in to support a ballot initiative to determine whether public tax dollars should be allowed to go to private schools.
What would citizen initiatives mean for Wisconsin? We're going to learn more about them and what they look like in other states. Scott Lacombe is an assistant professor of government and of statistical and data sciences at Smith College. Scott, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
My pleasure.
Now, before we get into the prospects of changes here in Wisconsin, I want to talk about our terms a little bit. Different states approach these things in different ways. Can you talk about the difference between different kinds of citizen initiatives and popular referenda?
Yeah, sure. So, right, there's a lot of very specific terminology here that most people are probably not aware of. So we have referendum in general, right? And this idea, it's being referred, right? So referendum, Wisconsin has this, right? Are laws sent from the legislature for the voters to vote on. And what is being proposed are what are called initiatives. And what distinguishes a referendum from an initiative is the citizens are initiating this process. So citizens are collecting signatures. The legislature is not part of this at all. The state government's not part of this at all. And so that's the real distinguishing factor here is for a different type of ballot measure. Initiatives in this case would be proposed by the voters.
Now here in Wisconsin, we can only see those things happening in national news when we hear reports about other states. How common are those citizen-initiated initiatives out there?
Yeah, so about half the states have it. 24 states have it. 26 do not have the initiative itself. Now, just because they have it doesn't mean they always use it. Mm-hmm. So we have some states like California where they might see 8, 10, 12 initiatives basically every general election. And then you have other states like Mississippi and Illinois that while they have this process, it's just not used very frequently, if at all.
Now we've got Governor Evers proposing this idea, and spoiler, Republicans in the legislature don't look like they're going to go along with it, so this may not happen anytime soon. From what you're seeing and hearing here in Wisconsin, what are the options that could be on the table for us?
Yeah, so I think you're absolutely right that the prospects of this happening are pretty slim right now. With the current Republican majority, they've just shown basically no interest in passing this. That being said, with the new state-level district boundaries, you know, 2026, 2028, who knows what direction the state legislature is going to go. But I would say until you see the elections either be consistently more competitive or even get a Democratic trifecta, there's really not a lot of options because the only way that the state can get this initiative process, be it for constitutional amendments or just laws, what we call a statutory initiative, you're going to need the state legislature on board to pass changes to the state constitution.
I want to talk a little bit about the political history of these citizen initiatives. As I understand it, some states came on board with it during the progressive era. But then I remember a period of time where initiatives were often driven by conservative agendas, funding changes in states like California. And then hold on, now modern day, we're seeing a lot of more liberal approaches, ending abortion restrictions, that kind of thing. How have you seen these things change over the years in terms of their partisan lean?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the most fascinating things about the ballot initiative that a lot of people just don't understand is it's not necessarily a conservative or a liberal institution. It's really dependent on the context that it was that it's existing in. In the progressive era, we see all these states start to propose these policies. Almost every state with the ballot initiative adopted it between, you know, basically 1900 and 1930, with a few exceptions. But really, the key thing to note about the initiative is it's what we call a corrective institution. So it's all dependent on where the state is relative to the people. And so if the state government's very conservative relative to the people, then it's going to pull policy in a more liberal direction and vice versa. And so right now we're really in a moment that Republicans just dominate at the state level, right? This is not just in Wisconsin. They control a majority of the state legislatures. They control almost a supermajority of governors as well. And so the only way that Democrats in a lot of these states are able to get policies passed is through institutions like the ballot initiative. Versus in earlier eras, right, where Democrats have a lot more control at the state level, you see things like the tax reform you're talking about or same-sex marriage bans or other policies being proposed in these states.
Now, an interesting phenomenon over the last year or two is we see some states, more conservative-leaning states, approve what might be seen as liberal ballot measures, say, on abortion, but then still elect candidates from a more conservative bent who oppose those kind of changes. What is it that makes voters lean one way, maybe an initiative, but still vote for politicians who would lean the other way?
Yeah, I mean, and this is also very interesting, and I think it frustrates a lot of people, right? So I grew up in Missouri, my home state, legalized marijuana, abortion, raised the minimum wage, but voted for a supermajority Republican legislature, right? And what that shows you is partisanship is complicated, right? In this current era where the parties are so polarized, you're almost certainly not going to agree with your party on every single issue. And something that the ballot initiative allows voters to do is say, well, we're on board with this party, be it Democrat or Republican, on a variety of issues, but we can extract the specific ones that we disagree with them on. So I can vote for President Trump, I can vote for Republican in my state legislature, but I can also vote to restore abortion rights in my state, right, which happened in a number of states in 2024. And so I think it's important to remember that voters aren't a monolith, and they have pretty distinct opinions that you can separate out from partisanship on a variety of issues.
Talking to Scott Lacombe from Smith College, looking at the idea of citizen initiatives. We don't have those in Wisconsin. Governor Evers says we should have some form of that. Scott, let's look at the arguments for and against. What are some of the main highlights of the debate over whether these citizen initiatives are a good idea?
Yeah, so advocates, and this is going all the way back to the progressive era, are going to say, right, our politics are corrupt. These party machines kind of control everything. And so we want to give power directly to the people. And I think that's really the core argument in favor of the initiative, is saying, let voters vote directly on this. And so you might have cleaner policies, right? Less corrupt policies. But it's also a check on the state government saying, hey, you stepped too far in one direction. On the other hand, right, arguments against really kind of focus on a couple different metrics, right? One is, are voters qualified to know and research all of the background behind these policies and vote directly on it, right? The point of a representative government is to have representatives, right, do their diligent research. And are voters really able to do that? And we see cases in states like California, for example, where there'll be three or four ballot measures on the exact same topic. And voters go, well, which one of these regulations do I want to pass, right? And so one is just the voters maybe aren't capable of making those decisions. But then also there's real fears of a tyranny of the majority, right? As we saw in the 2000s, a lot of states banned same-sex marriage with a simple majority vote. And so if we don't have this legislature that's kind of filtering out legislation in a, you know, very ideal context, then the ballot initiative might end up creating too many options for a tyranny of the majority.
I want to look at some of the practical elements here. Different states have different thresholds on their referenda. So in some cases, it's the majority approves the referendum, great, it's in. We saw Florida, a majority of voters supported marijuana legalization, but hang on, there was, I think, a 60% threshold. What are some of the different variations in the rules of how these things work?
Yeah, so there's two major ones, and you just hit one exactly, right? Different states have different thresholds for how high of a percentage you need to pass the legislation. So as you noted, in Florida, you need 60%, not 50. There are also other ways in which initiatives are different. Some states have higher thresholds for how many signatures you need to collect, right? So in some states, they say to get an initiative directly on the ballot, you need 4 or 5% of the voters to sign onto this initiative. Other states, it's as high as 12 or 13%. And so that's a huge difference. It's obviously gonna be a lot harder to get an initiative on the ballot with a high signature requirement. And then also some states have what we call distribution requirements. So it's not good enough to just get 5, 10, whatever percent of voters to sign on to this initiative, but you need them to be distributed across all the congressional districts in the state. And you particularly see this in states with a big rural-urban divide, because the fear is, well, we don't want these urban communities to, right, dominate state politics. We want to make sure the whole state's on board with this.
A big question is, who writes the question? How is the language of a ballot question determined? In Wisconsin, it comes out of the legislature for these constitutional ones. The way you ask a question, we know from polling, can influence how people feel about it. How does the language get developed under these citizen initiative processes?
Yeah, this has been a huge sticking point recently. And so in many states, the Secretary of State is the one that writes this ballot measure. They get to propose a summary of here's what the measure will and won't do. Other states, interest groups can actually write the text itself, including the rationale for and against it. And what has been a real focal point in fights in recent years are discussions on how can you frame this issue to voters, right? In Missouri, we had a law repealing the abortion ban, an initiative. And in that state, the Secretary of State tried to add justification opposing the initiative by saying, this is going to cost billions of dollars to the state, right? Because we're going to have people get aborted. We're no longer going to have them earning money, tax revenue, all of that. And so as you can imagine, advocates of this initiative were furious. They fought this with the judge saying, right, you can't include this kind of language. That's not a justifiable cost. And you see these battles all over the country and who gets to write these bills, because that's going to dramatically influence how voters feel about these initiatives.
Then I wonder about implementation, because even here in Wisconsin, without these citizen initiatives, we spend a lot of time in courts between lawmakers and the executive branch and businesses and things about how we put laws that are passed into practice. Well, now we've got these initiatives. They're summed up in, a couple lines or a paragraph on our ballot. Has it been a challenge to take that starting point and then put it into practice?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's obviously going to vary by the bill itself, but there's been all sorts of fights over to what extent legislatures are bound by whatever the initiative says, particularly if it's really vague language. So to give you an example, several states have expanded Medicaid through the ballot initiative. Well, where's the funding mechanism for that, right? Who gets to allocate that spending? At what level? And you see these fights time and time again on many initiatives. And that's definitely one of the arguments against these initiatives is, right, we don't want to do legislation through one paragraph discussions, right? We want long bills. We want lots of text. And so this absolutely is an area that's created a lot of tension in the states.
I want to get into some of your research. You've looked at the question of, okay, if we have citizen initiative processes, does that mean we are changing the law more? Or does it mean that law changes that are happening around the country happen faster in states with this process versus states that don't have it? What kind of things do we know?
Generally, what we can say is that states with the initiative process tend to be more innovative. They tend to pass policies faster. Now, the reason that we think that is the case is you have this new tension in the state where the legislature knows, hey, if we don't act, then the voters are going to overturn what we, you know, tried to do, right? Or if we pass policies that they don't like. And so because the legislatures know they just have this constant pressure, and so because of that, they're constantly going to be worried, well, if we don't pass these policies now, then the voters are going to pass something we like even less. And so they're constantly adjusting their policies. It's not always the case, right? There's some situations where the initiative may actually stop policies from being passed that otherwise would have. But generally, we can say that these states tend to be more innovative and their policies tend to more closely track what the public wants.
Well, to take a concrete example that comes up a lot, various forms of marijuana legalization, medical and recreational. Wisconsin, a big holdout among a lot of our neighboring states in not having any kind of legalization. So the argument might be there, okay, if there was that initiative process, lawmakers who were worried about marijuana legalization might be motivated to pass something, but with more restrictions versus the fear of a citizen initiative that throws the door wide open. Is that something that could conceivably happen in that framework?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think you hit the nail on the head, right? Initiatives are very costly. It takes a lot of time and money to, you know, collect all these signatures, to run ads, to campaign on it. And so if the legislature can get just close enough to the public where that effort isn't worth it, then that's a way that they can kind of neutralize the initiatives. But you look at a map of the states, particularly in the Midwest, and Wisconsin just stands out time and time again, along with Iowa, of being surrounded by states with legalized marijuana, a higher minimum wage, a Medicaid expansion, all these policies that the legislature would face far more pressure to consider, at least, if the state had the initiative process.
Scott, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much.
Scott Lacombe is an assistant professor of government and of statistical and data sciences at Smith College. He talked to us about citizen-led referenda and ballot initiatives.
Girl Scout cookies are starting to show up around the state, and that's got some people here at WPR pretty excited. Hint, rhymes with Bob Barrett.
Hey, that kind of rhymes with my name. But here's a cookie mystery I've run across before. Girl Scout cookies have different names in some communities, and the cookies themselves can be a little different depending on where you are. For example, in some places you got tagalongs, and others peanut butter patties, some have Samoas, others have caramel delights.
The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel did some digging into this Girl Scout cookie situation. Turns out there are two different companies that make Girl Scout cookies, and each regional council picks one of them. Five of the state's councils go with one of the manufacturers. A council in Northeast Wisconsin, they go with the other one.
I think I need to head out on a fact-finding trip around the state with lots of samples.
Do you have a favorite Girl Scout cookie or perhaps a memory of selling them over the years? I know I do. Or maybe you're getting ready to sell them right now. We want to hear about it.
You can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or call or text at 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is WPR News.